In the first evening of the retreat, I mentioned the analogy of a farmer growing plants, that a farmer might plant the seeds, but besides that, the farmer doesn't make the plant grow, but rather provides the conditions by which the plant can grow. And so we create the conditions for the path of practice to grow in us. And one of the remarkable aspects of the Buddha's descriptions of walking along the path is that often he talked about the unfolding of the path in impersonal ways. It's certainly happening to a person. It's all about individuals who are walking the path. There's no denying the individual. But it's not his chosen way to describe the unfolding. As the practice deepens, the subjective kind of transformations that go on. And so one of the frequent presentations on the how the path unfolds is with the arising of gladness. And when gladness arises, joy is born. There isn't any mention of the person who's glad or is joyful. And there's no instructions to be the one who makes gladness arise or make joy. Put on a nice face and be happy. But it talks about it just arises, this bubbles up. And it's a wonderful thing to have the experience of practicing and to see how some of this works. Some of the stepping, so you don't have to take so much responsibility for everything, but to trust an unfolding, trust what emerges and arises and moves through us. And it's probably easiest to trust when it's things like gladness, joy, tranquility, happiness, concentration. This is great. Go along for the ride. It's more difficult to trust when it's anger that as you sit there and trusting the experience, it turns into rage. That can't be right. But sometimes, you know, it could be that anger that's never been had a chance, never had a time to come out, always been pushed down or ignored or denied. And so when finally the inhibitions and the resistance are no longer there, it comes out in its full force. It comes out as rage. And it's not going backwards. It can be going forwards because it's kind of emptying out. It's kind of finally has a chance to use up the energy that's been bottled up to show itself, get known. Maybe it needs to be seen. Maybe the anger is something that has a tremendous need to be loved, to be met with compassion and care. And the movement from anger to rage is part of that call for take a look here. This needs you. Or to feel the physical pains that can happen on retreat. To trust that this is maybe part of the process as well, sometimes, and to let it unfold. And sometimes the tradition talks about the path of purification. It's a very powerful language, the language of purification, because sometimes that's what it feels like. That things are being purified, we're kind of all this maybe not, you don't have any of this in you, but all this gunk comes up that has to be processed and come out. And then in the ancient language, the teachings of the Buddha, he used the language of vomiting. And sometimes people have that more common, that they have a feeling they need to vomit. But occasionally people vomit because of somehow what's being held inside, it's the only way somehow of processing it or letting it finally kind of be released, be freed, be emptied out. So it's hard to trust those things. It's just so unpleasant, embarrassing. But in the practice of mindfulness, if you sit and are honest, practice of truth-telling in the moment, practice of not having any conflict with what is, the practice of not participating in what is, in terms of stories and reactions and beliefs, if we don't accept it, and we also don't reject it. We're not in conflict with it, not for it or against it. It's a powerful practice, and to feel the safety and the trust and the value of getting out of our own way and staying present and letting these things move through us. Because we don't really know what needs to happen. We don't really know what purification, what release. We don't really know what's being born in us. There's a saying that no seed or seeds germinate in the dark, and flowers bloom in the light. So you might want to have only flowers in your life. But flowers began as seeds. And, you know, the idea that seeds grow in the dark under the soil, that our seeds inside of us, we have all these things that maybe need to germinate, but we don't know what those seeds are. We're like farmers who planted a seed or have seeds planted in them that need to germinate, but we don't really know what they are. But the condition of trust, of openness, of non-reactivity, of non-participation, not getting engaged, but making space, not acting on them, but making space, allows some phenomenal inner process to unfold, as if the heart, the mind, knows how to heal. The heart knows how to move to freedom and liberation. And it's a process which seemingly happens without our usual self-conscious or intentional part of who we think we are operating. Much like if you're in the kitchen and you cut your finger on the knife chopping vegetables. So you clean it and put a Band-Aid on it and keep it dry. And you try to create the optimal conditions for the cut to heal. And I believe it's a phenomenally complex process, the healing of a cut. All the different probably chemicals and enzymes and proteins and antibodies and all kinds of things have to operate in order for the body to gear up and to create that healing. And I suspect that I'm pretty confident that I don't have the intelligence to track all the things that have to be tracked and taken care of and send them all down to the cut and just the right amount. But somehow this body seems to know how to do it. So I don't do it. I wouldn't say that I am healing the cut. But I am healing the cut in the sense that my body is healing the cut. Am I my body? Well, there's a way in which we talk where we say, you know, that I didn't heal the cut. The body did it. Something else, you know, something. The I that's self-conscious, the I that directs things or wants things, intends things, and organizes things and controls things. That, whatever that is, that wasn't doing it. The body knew. And so the job, my job is to keep the cut clean, create the conditions for it. So the same thing for the heart. That the heart, the inner life, kind of knows how to move towards health, to healing, to freedom, if we create the conditions for it. And I think of mindfulness practice as a practice of love, practice of holding our experience with goodwill or space or compassion. Or not that we have to actively love, but the act of seeing something carefully, really being seen, is so important. As a teacher, I have now talked with many people about their lives. And one of the great sufferings that some people carry, very difficult suffering, is when they were not seen as children. And to not be seen is almost the same as not being loved. This idea of being seen is so important. And so, you know, when we see ourselves, we see our life and our situation, we're bringing that kind of love or something very profound, that some of the disowned parts of ourselves have a chance finally to be seen. And then only by being seen can it begin to unfold. And so sometimes it's, you know, it's difficult what has to come up. But to learn to trust this process and not to constantly refer it back to me, myself, and mine. Not to every time there's something that, oh, this is, you know, this reflects back on me. This is embarrassing, or this is proves that I'm somehow an odd person. Proves that I'm, you know, somehow at fault or anything at all. Just we're so quick to kind of interpret things through the filter of taking it personally, defining ourselves by it. But just it's difficult stuff coming up, and leaving it very simple, and just seeing it, holding it, being with it, and to do this often enough, especially like I think in meditation and being on retreat, to do it often enough to begin to trust that process, see it operating in us, and then learning, oh yeah, I can trust this. I don't have to be always in the driver's seat. It's not only about me doing, and not only about defining myself by this. I have to do my part, create the conditions. But then it's almost like an impersonal process that begins to unfold. And even the movement of the path to awakening is impersonal. So it's a phenomenal process. It's a wonderful thing that goes on. And as I talked about earlier, that the Buddha described this with the analogy of a river, you know, water flowing down a mountainside and becoming a streams, creeks and streams and rivers, and finally coming to the ocean. It's a natural process that unfolds. And now we come towards the end of the retreat. And, you know, it's time soon to come out of the retreat and begin again a life that's more normal or more odd, whatever way you want to see it. And so how do we live out there with all this? And one of the One of the things that, one of the maybe seeds or one of the capacities we have inside, faculties that we have inside, that can operate without the so-called I doing it, being it, is wisdom, is understanding. And that's also a phenomenal thing to learn to trust, that there's something inside of us that is wise, or to knows how to respond, knows how to act, knows what to do. And to begin to make space for that. And if we're always self-conscious, maybe there's very little space for wisdom to operate. It's kind of like we fill the wavelengths, you know, with all our self-preoccupation, self-concern, and whatever, all the different forms it takes. And so there's no more space, no more bandwidth anymore for the wisdom to come in. And it might seem like I don't have any wisdom, or my wisdom is pretty puny. It's probably because it never had any, never given the chance to. You never turned the channel on to the wisdom channel, because you're always, you know, you were always on the shopping channel. And that's, I think, another, you know, phenomenal benefit to this practice is, again, it's not quick and easy, but to learn to trust that you don't have to always know. You don't have to always be the one who figures it out. You don't have to be the one who prepares for everything. Not only don't you have to, but sometimes you're better off not to, because there's something inside that can operate then. There's wisdom that can operate. In the suttas, there is the idea that a person at some point, as they mature in this practice, becomes a stream enterer. And there's a lot of fancy ideas about what it means to be a stream enterer, enter the stream. But, you know, remember this an analogy of the river flowing down the mountainside. At some point we enter that stream of practice, and it begins to unfold. And so we get out of the way, and something begins to unfold, these steps, process of practice. And so stream enterer is someone who's entered the stream of practice and trusts it, has faith in it, and it begins, something begins to move. And we have to create the conditions, but and then once someone asked Buddha's disciple Sariputta, what's the stream that these stream enterers enter? And Sariputta said, it's the Noble Eightfold Path. And then, is this something they practice, the Noble Eightfold Path? The Eightfold Path is what they possess. It's what they are. So rather than the Eightfold Path being a practice that leads to awakening, leads to spiritual maturation, one of the ways in the suttas the Noble Eightfold Path is discussed, it's actually a description of how someone behaves if they're spiritually mature. As if there's a natural tendency to orient oneself by these eight factors of the Eightfold Path. And so the ancient texts assume that someone who's spiritually mature, of course, will not kill, of course, will not lie, of course, that they won't be cruel or unkind. They'll be compassionate. They'll have kindness. They'll be truthful. Not because they're told to and they think that's supposed to be, that's a good idea, and you know, I need to be a good Buddhist and get organized here. But rather, there's something about the nature of our heart, mind, that when it's settled, when it's at peace, when it's not in conflict, when it's not driven by greed, hate, and delusion, that there's a, it seems to be that there's powerful motivations and understandings, a reference point for how to live in the world. And it doesn't have to be that complicated. As we kind of release the tension, the holding, the clinging we have, we're familiar with how painful that is and we release it, that whole experience of even temporary experience of being free of clinging, of attachment, becomes a reference point that helps us to see when we cling next time. And then we see that that is, ouch, it hurts. It hurts to cling. And then you have, and then to see that clearly, and to know that there's the option not to cling, that's a reference point. And then you can decide, what do you want to do here? Do you cling or do you not cling? And there comes a time where you have more and more choice in that department. It's not automatically that you cling. Do you keep your ease or do you sacrifice your ease? One of the great practice statements to carry around with you as a challenge, as a way of kind of wrestling and looking at yourself, is the statement, nothing whatsoever is worth sacrificing your ease for. Nothing whatsoever is worth sacrificing your ease. So maybe all of you have now exceptions, but some people are quick to, but you know, they want to argue the buts. But maybe argue, you know, have the debate. Is it really worth it? And when you realize that you can respond to the world better when there's ease, then it's hard to argue that there's a purpose for losing the ease. When you're more effective, when you're at ease, then why sacrifice it? When wisdom is more available, when there's ease, don't we want to act from our wisdom? If love and compassion is more available in our ease, don't we want to stay close to love and compassion? So that becomes kind of a guiding compass for us. It's very simple, knowing when there's ease, knowing where there's lack of clinging, and knowing when there's unease, knowing when there's clinging. And just knowing that, if we really know it, if we really feel it in an intimate and present in a relaxed way with it, it becomes as natural to respond wisely to that as it is to take a thorn out of your foot when you're walking. It's not like rocket science. You don't need complicated philosophy to take the thorn out. You don't need complicated philosophy to, you know, to feel the ouch, to feel the discomfort, and to realize this is not healthy, it's not good for me or for the world and for others. It becomes a reference point. Oh, I don't have to do this. And so choosing ease, choosing to be not in conflict, choosing to be a different way, is part of the training of practice. And it takes a lot of trust. It takes a lot of being willing to take risks. It takes sometimes a willingness to step forward into life with some fear, because it can be a little bit frightening, or very frightening, to step forward without worrying. worrying sometimes is much better than being scared. But if we let go of the worry, it can be very small. Who am I? How do I do this? I remember when, after a few years of doing this practice, I saw that how much I was clinging to certain self-concepts and who I felt like I was or had to be, and how I behaved around that, and how I tried to, you know, when I had conversations with people, I tried to manipulate them in how I talked so they would see me the way I should be seen. You know, and just always playing the social game, and I could see how I was doing it, and it's, I wanted to let go of it. I felt like this doesn't serve me, and I wanted to, and I could feel that I was too afraid to let go of it. It was maybe too open, too raw, too vulnerable. It was kind of a little bit, it felt safer to hide behind the mask or the playing the game, even though I knew it was, I knew it was harmful and detrimental, but somehow it's more comfortable. So it took a while to kind of step into that place of, that felt so tentative, and learn to relax, and learn that it worked out okay, it was trustable. So this idea that the Eightfold Path becomes who we are is, I think, a powerful idea, that we have within us what it takes to live the mature life, the mature spiritual life. It's not like we have to do something. It's more like we have to settle back. And so this idea that when we let go, we don't just let go of something, we can let go into ourselves. We can let go into, there's actually something here that holds us up. When we let go of self-concept, you're not left with nothing. In this kind of discussion, you know, if you let go fully enough, you're left with the Eightfold Path. That's called noble. Isn't that pretty cool? Another way that the Eightfold Path is talked about in the suttas, besides being called a stream, it's also called a chariot. And a chariot is something you get to ride in. You know, you don't have to you don't push the chariot. That doesn't work very well. But you get to ride in the chariot, and it carries you along. The Buddha lived these days, he'd probably say it was an escalator. You know, or something, you know, it carries you along. And but in ancient world, I think that my understanding is a chariot was a vehicle of nobility. Of the wealthy had chariots. Generals and army had chariots. Chariots were kind of like hot stuff. I don't know if Buddha these days would say that the Eightfold Path is like a Hummer. I don't think that would go over very well. But this idea that we're being carried, there is something there. If we let go fully, we're not left with nothing. We're left with something. It's not something you can call yours. Like, this is who I am. It's mine. I'm this. And you don't want to anyway, because as soon as you take possession of any of this, this is me. Look how great I am. If you're being mindful and careful, you'll feel the contraction. You'll feel the loss of the ease. You'll feel the ouch. And if you want to live a life of no ouch, don't take possession of the Eightfold Path. Don't take possession of the wisdom that you have. Don't take possession of what's going on. So it can be a big word, the word wisdom. And it could be a daunting word because it's, that's like solving the national debt or something. It's like, big problems, right? Solved by wisdom. I think one of the really important capacities we have is the capacity to say no. The veto power. We have veto power over our impulses. We don't have to speak. We don't have to act right away often. And, you know, sometimes in emergency we do, but in so many different situations, we don't have to immediately react. Don't have to immediately respond to it. And so there's a choice to say, not now, let's wait. Let's make space, let's see. And I think I mentioned this earlier, but you know, you're in a difficult, large holiday gathering with all your family, and some of those members have been very trying and difficult. And you always have the ability to hold your tongue. I don't know if you have the ability, but you have that possibility of holding your tongue. And I wouldn't underestimate how important that ability is. Don't cause any harm. Don't give in. Don't react. Don't repress what you're feeling to yourself. But if you're angry at someone, you have the ability not to have that anger spill out in what you say and do to others. If you feel strong desire for something and you want something, that hasn't to spill out and you don't have to act on it. And that simple ability, simple but not always easy to do, but the ability to not do is amazingly helpful and useful. Because if you cannot do, if you're in doubt, don't do. But don't do because you're afraid. Don't do because you're just going to ignore the situation. But don't do so you can take a better look at the situation. So you can take a second look. I can tell you, I mean, I don't know, but tens of thousands of times in my life where I luckily waited before I said something. And waited to hear more what was going on and to understand better what was happening. And then, oh, the situation is different than I thought. I was about to say something based on a premature idea of what was happening. But I'm so glad I waited and found out more, discovered more. The world becomes richer. Our friends become richer. We take the time to hear and find out what's there, what's going on. And so this ability not to act is an act of, and to know, to recognize when we're acting and when maybe it's best to wait a moment or when it's best to excuse ourselves from the situation and come back 2 minutes later, a minute later, or tell your friend, I think you just need to be quiet for a minute and think about this. That is wisdom operating. Wisdom, again, doesn't have to be big, complicated problem solvings. But it's that simple. Just, I'm not going to act right now. This is not the time. I don't have confidence in what I want to say or do. If I don't have confidence, maybe I'll wait a little bit and wait and see what comes up. What seeds want to germinate? What else happens inside of me if I stay present and notice myself, my feelings, my reactions, and hold it in awareness when I study the situation? And that allows wisdom to arise, other understandings to arise. One of the things that, I'm probably still learning to do this, but there can be situations where something's happening and I'm expected to do something I feel kind of uncomfortable inside. Something feels off. And I've learned that if I feel off inside or uncomfortable, that's a really important signal that maybe something is off. And I don't have the mind that understands why what's wrong. It might seem like a good idea, but something inside kind of, oh no. And there are times in my life when I was younger when I overrode that. I just kind of either didn't notice it, or I didn't think it was important, or, you know, or I felt the sense of obligation. I was obligated to do the things I had to do. And but, you know, slowly I'm learning to pay attention to that and listen to that, those feelings, the inner voices. No, there's something's wrong here. That's wisdom operating, to listen to that and stop and pay attention to that. Because maybe you need to understand something better. Spend a little bit of time, wait, look, find out what's happening here. Have you ever been at a grocery checkout counter and fallen in love with a clerk checking you out? Not romantically, but, you know, just kind of like, just in the 2 minutes you had there, somehow took the time to connect to the person or to look at the person and feel the person and just really kind of, this is a human being who was a child, who grew up, who had challenges, had joys, maybe has family, has, you know, all kinds of things. It's a human being. And take it all, sit back and open, look. And occasionally, it's really nice. Sometimes these checkout counter people, some of them couldn't care less that you're there. You know, they don't notice you, even though you're looking at them. But sometimes you'll meet someone who looks back, and it's sometimes it's just a delightful kind of interchange of the eyes, like, oh, like a mutual recognition. You know, how are you? Good. Have a nice day. But it just feels, you know, deeper than that because of the kind of presence and contact. 2 minutes. In any case, do you have better things to do at the checkout counter? You have better things to do, you know? Make 100% sure they don't charge you 40 cents too much for the apples. I mean, yeah, it's a good thing to save your money, right? Your 40 cents, yeah, it's a good thing. But is it worth saving 40 cents compared to having some, you know, real human contact with someone? It doesn't have to take long to feel someone deeply. And there's wisdom. To feel, to be able to stop and open and discover, what does it take to kind of be there in a maybe undefended way or open way and take someone in? It seems that in the ancient suttas that the Buddha expected that people who were spiritually mature would have loving kindness and compassion. And I think that's why there's a lot of teachings about it, actually, but there's an it's more like, of course, that's what's going to arise, that's what's going to be there. And that's certainly been my experience, and some of the, you know, the great joys of doing this practice is having compassion uninvited and not wanted, because I didn't know I wanted it. You know, I had no interest in compassion whatsoever. Thank you. And then, lo and behold, it like wells up in doing this practice. And I had no interest in loving kindness. Actually, there was loving kindness. Compassion just like wasn't on my radar, really. But loving kindness, it was on my radar because some of these teachers would talk about it. And, what a drag. And, you know, it was so, you know, artificial and sweet. And I just like, give me a break. I just want the truth. The real stuff. And, but then loving kindness wells up. What's going on here? I didn't ask for this. And discovering these things are tremendous treasures. These tremendous, wonderful things. So I've had the experience that in doing the practice that loving kindness, compassion well up and just arise out of the space that's created. That's kind of wisdom to have that. That's a source of wisdom. If wisdom is not connected to love and compassion, I don't know. How good is it? So there is something inside of us that knows. There is something inside of us that can be a guide. There is something inside of us that can provide us with wisdom for how to live our lives. And I like to think of whatever that is pretty shy. It's pretty shy. And so we have to kind of be quiet enough or sensitive enough or willing enough to pay attention, to hear it, initially at least. And it has some great, you know, it's really great to feel like you have access to that and you can trust that, so you don't have to always go prepared for everything. You don't have to plan everything out. Because maybe it's not possible to plan. Maybe it's more interesting to show up and then see what arises from the causes and conditions. See how this, what's in our heart can, what gets born, what response there is. See how the Eightfold Path or love and compassion or wisdom, how it wants to operate in different situations. See what comes out of your mouth. So this freedom that can come when we don't feel like we're responsible for everything ourselves. We don't refer everything back to the self and me, myself, and mine. And letting go of these attachments and self-concepts, and as I've said, does not result in nothing. And we can't say, you are left with nothing. But maybe you can say, everything is left without you. Isn't that pretty nice? You get everything when you're able to drop some of the self. But if you hold on to the self, then you get nothing, really. Looks like you're getting something. But there's so much waiting for you, so much here, in your heart, in your mind, in this world, that you create the conditions for, and the wonderful things will well up from your heart. Wonderful things are waiting for you inside. There are treasures upon treasures within. But it requires you to create the conditions for it. And the two conditions, as I said earlier in the retreat, the two primary conditions that, at least my reading of what the Buddha taught, that he said in different ways, but the two primary conditions is a family of things, the family of activities that fit under the category of letting go, relaxing, and the family of activities having to do with knowing, being mindful, seeing, observing. So these two, there are two things we can do. And sometimes we emphasize the knowing and the seeing, and sometimes we can do the letting go. Sometimes we do the knowing and seeing, and sometimes the letting go happens. And that's another wonderful thing, is sometimes we don't have to do the letting go, but the letting go happens when we see clearly. And so I put pride of place for the condition that we need to do is awareness, being present for experience, truth-telling, seeing clearly, observing. And because so much just follows almost naturally or naturally from that. And even letting go happens that way. And the advantage of that is that then letting go happens at the right time. Sometimes it's not the time to let go. Even though we think good Buddhists are supposed to let go at every opportunity. Who knows? Who knows when the right time is? Who knows what's going on? So to make space, time, open. So as we leave this retreat, that to know that how we live our lives, the wisdom we need to have to how to live our life, is waiting for you here inside. You have, probably for each of you, you have much, much, much more wisdom than you can possibly imagine. If you can learn to listen and open up and get out of the way. So then, to change gears, a few announcements about today. So today is the last day, a full day of the retreat. And the schedule changes in the evening from what it has been. It's a very small change, and that is the meditation session that begins at 7:45 will start at 7:30. And who is it that rings the bell for that sitting?
Six, yes. 6:45 to 7:15.
No, that stays the same. But the one that starts at 7:45, so you need to ring your bell 15 minutes before you usually do. Okay? And then you don't have to sit up here. And then we'll have an hour in here. And everyone please come to that hour, because we'll do a little sitting. I'll do a little talk, we'll do a little question and answer period about, you know, I didn't give you a chance to ask any questions. So I'll give you a chance. And in the hall here, and then there's closing announcements we do. And so please everyone come to that. And then, so I don't know if any of you are flying out tomorrow someplace, but if you need to print your boarding pass, you can leave a note with the manager, with Liz, and then she'll leave you a note by when you can come into the office to use the office computer to print out your boarding pass. And there'll be more announcements, things you need to know. Everything you'll need to know will become clear as we go along. And but for now, that's all you need to know. We kind of operate a little bit on a on-need basis. So. For now, this is what you need to know. And so let's take maybe 2 minutes to sit.